Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Bassetta, Assistant Professor of Communication and Media at Lund University. Remember, you can follow the show on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or visit us on the web at socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all. Thanks so much for tuning in. I've got a real treat lined up for you today, and that is a conversation with Professor Lance Bennett. He is Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Communication at the University of Washington, and really one of the founders of the field of political communication. So in this episode, we're going to have a general discussion around the kind of state of play of platforms and democracy, and how to think about values that can provide regulatory guardrails in thinking about how to deal with the disruption that these platforms have caused to democratic processes. And I want to clarify that disruption does not necessarily mean a negative connotation, but tech platforms are in the business of disrupting established industries, such as the taxicab industry or the hotel industry with Uber and Airbnb, respectively. So there's really no counterargument to the fact that platforms have disrupted our general thinking about democracy, right? The way that we participate in civic and political life. So this conversation is going to be really grounded in an article that Professor Bennett wrote last year entitled Killing the Golden Goose, a Framework for Regulating Disruptive Technologies, that's published in Information, Communication, and Society. And there'll be a link down to that article in the episode description. But what I really like about this article and what we'll talk about in the episode is this idea of capitalism and putting the modern day technology disruptive practices into a broader framework of capitalism. And that sounds like big and grand and theoretical, but it's really important, I think, because if we think about what academics are interested in or what political scientists particularly are interested in, that is the health of democracy and democratic processes. But that's not necessarily what companies are interested in, whether they're tech companies or any other type of company like McDonald's or Nike. What companies are interested in fundamentally is increasing their bottom lines, delivering profit to shareholders, and increasing their market share. So in that regard, I think we do need to think about where the state of play of platforms is in a larger thinking of the relationship and often the tension between capitalism and democracy. Because if we think about that relationship historically, it is governments and regulators who, with any communication technology, eventually need to put in guardrails. And those guardrails, in a sense, provide the values that the corporate enterprise logic doesn't have. For example, protecting consumers or keeping the kind of overall system in check. That's what regulation does. So we'll hear Professor Bennett's thoughts on what he thinks those values and those regulatory guardrails should be. And I'll just mention that this was a special recording because it was in person and on the back porch of Konrad Adenauer's summer villa, Konrad Adenauer being the first post-war chancellor of West Germany and a founder of the CDU. So you may hear some airplanes flying overhead because we were adamant about recording outside so that we could have this conversation over cigars and a glass of bourbon. There's a nice picture of that up on the Twitter page. But without further ado, let me turn it over to Professor Lance Bennett. Again, he is a professor emeritus of political science and communication at the University of Washington.
Professor Bennett, thanks for taking the time out and welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
It's great to be here, Michael.
So I have to forewarn both you and the listeners, the questions are quite long here, so bear with me. I'd like to take a deep dive into your ideas about democratic disruption, but why don't we start out by situating it within the broader intellectual tradition of capitalism and democracy. In the article I've introduced to the listeners, you start out by discussing how classic economic theorists like Marx, Engels, and Schumpeter discuss how economic systems periodically go bust and then pave the way for new modes of production and new technologies. So do you mind recapping that argument for us and then situating the rise of tech companies within that type of capitalist and democracy thinking? Are we simply in a new phase of capitalism, or is there something different with how tech companies have moved fast and broke things?
Wow, that's a great question. I suppose that most of the early, especially socialist theorists of capitalism, saw capitalism as a very socially destructive regime in which power was very unequally divided between owners and workers. And the constant refreshment of markets and technologies often displaced old workers and social groups that had found a niche, but only to have to find a new one for themselves. And of course, as power was ever more accumulated, you got monopolies and ownership of sectors of entire economies, in the result that sort of social relations of people were quite challenged and often really immiserated. And to move that forward to a much less Marxist perspective, the revisitation of that set of claims by Joseph Schumpeter in the 20th century led to a theory that there is a creative destruction process involved in these capital reformations and displacements. And Schumpeter added the interesting element of the tension between capitalism and democracy itself, and making the claim that in the effort to strike a balance between some measure of sovereignty and popular power and the regulation of capitalism and markets, you ended up limiting both systems. So you limited the capacity of capitalism to be itself, and capitalism in turn limited the capacity of democracy to be truly egalitarian and, you know, based on popular sovereignty. So that was kind of where it sits. And I think we see those tensions today. I mean, it's clear to me that it is very hard to create a harmony between democratic process and markets and capital power in societies. And now, flash forward, you have Silicon Valley in particular and the tech industries in general actually raising the idea of move fast and break things, or disruption, as a positive value, as something that's a good thing, which of course is subject to some inspection. I mean, what it's good for is creating enormous wealth in the tech sector, and at the same time, displacing entire economic sectors, such as taxi cab industry is sort of being replaced by Uber and Lyft and other rideshare operations. And so you can go through sector after sector after sector. The legacy media are slowly being eroded. Journalism is being eroded by the production of information that is driven by platforms.
Yeah, and I want to return to this idea of capitalism and the markets. But core to these, you know, these economic models is the notion of regulation, that eventually regulation comes in and kind of fixes some of the disruption. And that seems to be the question everyone is asking these days, right? How do we regulate these platforms? And before getting to your value-based framework, why don't we highlight what doesn't seem to be working? After the 2016 elections and all these Senate hearings around election interference, the consensus seemed to be an increased push towards industry self-regulation, particularly between, you know, Twitter, Alphabet, and Meta. Well, meanwhile, in the EU, we've had these kind of codes of conduct around disinformation, which is also a kind of self-regulation practice. And you argue that this self-regulation model is flawed because of social and political cross-pressures. I think it's an interesting take. So can you outline this argument about cross-pressures? What are they, and why do you think they're unlikely to go away anytime soon?
Well, there are several different types of cross-pressures, the most obvious of which is that groups in society that have been targeted with hate speech, institutional processes like elections that have been hit with disinformation about such basic things as who won this election in the case of Trump in 2020, you know, sort of have exceeded the capacity of corporations to self-regulate. For a whole variety of reasons. One is that there are so many disruptive elements to platforms and other digital technologies that it's, you know, extremely hard to figure out how to regulate them all, because they're not all the same. They're really moving in some different directions. Another cross pressure, of course, is political. So as we move from self-regulation, which has fairly clearly failed in a lot of ways that we might want to talk about, what ends up is that you get pressures for governments to step in. And the EU has actually done a much better job than, say, the US in finding some regulatory leverage over things such as privacy and giving users some consent over what kinds of privacy settings that they want to choose. But as you get farther into government regulation, it seems to me that the problem becomes fundamentally political, because politicians and parties are becoming more and more dependent on these platforms for communicating with their voters and their publics. And to regulate them in ways that might infringe that becomes a sort of a conflict of interest on the part of government itself. And as you can imagine, as political parties, particularly on the right, that are actively using disinformation and emotionally based communication to mobilize voters through fear and anger and other conflicts, that you get government players, such as parties and political players, really reluctant to mess with that, to change the secret formulas that help them reach their voters and mobilize those voters. And so to the extent that the right in this case grows, you will have more and more trouble getting any kind of consensus from governments, states, on what kind of regulation we can have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of this argument that, some of these, I think Trump even said himself, I wouldn't be elected if it wasn't for social media. And so there is sort of a connection a cross pressure where there's two sides of it, where these platforms help politicians get elected, but then maybe they don't want to regulate the platforms that helped get them there in the first place.
Exactly. And so now you have cases where Elon Musk has just purchased Twitter, and we'll see how this goes, but has vowed to make it an open platform with few restrictions and few moderation conventions. And that could actually multiply the problems for regulation. It may create new calls for regulation at the same time. But in addition to the political cross pressures that make it difficult for political stakeholders to agree on any kind of regulatory scheme, you also end up having those who are in favor of regulation perhaps not fully understanding how the tech companies themselves really work. So to take a simple example, the EU, as I said, has been very progressive in the regulatory approaches. But for example, the latest round of EU regulations is often aimed at increasing market competition for new companies entering sectors with new products, new platforms, which on the face of it sounds good. But there are at least two problems with that. The first problem is that users, people who drive the markets from the user end, tend to want to use the most populated platforms because that's where the big networks are. That's where the most robust information flows are. That's where you can share and spread your content the farthest, allowing small startups to come into these sectors. And there always will be some startups that do come in and do well. But the idea of trying to create more platforms that compete on the same terms is actually likely to create new problems that we might want to talk about. For example, if there are problems with tech companies such as disinformation, how will you deal with that with new players? I mean, some of the new players, in fact, have been Telegraph and so on, have been actually more involved in spreading disinformation than some of the old players. So there's that regulatory set of issues, and it's a complicated set of issues. But, there are other problems in terms of regulators perhaps not fully understanding what markets actually need to be regulated. So, for example, the idea of regulating competition in industries is one set of issues, but the more fundamental elements of the tech business involve data ownership, data gathering, and use. So regulating data markets turns out to be a very, very tricky business. And I think where the important action is going to be in regulation is figuring out how to regulate data. And the EU has been talking about whether it ever comes to fruition, we'll have to see. But the EU has been talking about actually setting up like public data banks where companies would sort of pay for access to data that will be limited by states in this case. And that doesn't solve a lot of the other problems with the tech companies. I mean, it may or may not improve privacy and data protection. It may remove data from ownership by companies. But it then puts data ownership in the public sector, which has its own set of capacities or potentials for corruption and misuse of data in those sectors, particularly when they're governed by different political parties that come into different kinds of governments.
Yeah. Definitely. And I mean, the regulation from the government side is obviously tough, but I want to pick up on the you've mentioned the EU a few times, and we've seen this kind of legislation with teeth coming out of the EU, such as GDPR and the Digital Services Act. Yeah, there's an interesting example of third-party tracking that you talk about in the paper, which shows, I think, how tech companies adopt to such regulatory moves. So there's a challenge of regulation, but then there's a challenge of how tech companies kind of circumvent it. And the example that I thought was interesting was of federated learning of cohorts or flocks, which I hadn't heard about before. So could you explain what these flocks are and what you think these kind of technical workarounds mean for the future of data privacy?
Well, characteristic of this entire collection of industries. This was a Google idea. And the basic idea was that instead of allowing third-party vendors to track us very systemically and many to then pool and auction our personal data, Google came up with a system that would essentially eliminate third-party vendors from these markets and replace it with Google owning more of the data, for one, but also pooling data in terms of groups of users who tend to be interested in similar things, shopping for clothes, buying cars, following football. And these groups then would be sort of sold as sort of more powerful access to levels of user interest and user activity than the individual level that is currently involved in third-party vendors. But it turns out there were a couple of problems with flocks, and this is how rapidly the industry changes these things. When Google did a beta test on their flocks model, it turned out that there was a lot of pushback from other browser, Safari, for example. And indeed, Apple began to allow its own users to make a number of privacy settings, such as blocking some cookies and eliminating some third-party vendors. I mean, if you've gone to the privacy choices in some websites, you kind of notice that there are sometimes 50 or 100 different vendors that are using our personal data, and then you're invited to make choices on which we have no basis for making. We have no knowledge to make those kinds of choices, and of course, nobody's going to do it because all you want to do is search for a TV program and not be bothered by figuring out how to decide who to let your data go to and who not. But the interesting thing about flocks, and this was just a year ago when this paper was published, that was the working concept. But there was enough pushback from the other partners, the other browsers in the world, for example, that Google has stepped back from flocks already, and they've now introduced a new concept. And this may be gone by the time your podcast hits the hits the air, called topics. And so the idea now is that we aggregate people into, football fans or Audi drivers or fashion shoppers of Dior and other high-end brand products. And then those users will be sold as a group, but for topics, and that people will not be included in those topics beyond a certain time limit, which is yet to be determined. So it's a kind of a moving set of targets. And the criticism of all of this involves, first of all, we're still being tracked. Second of all, the flocks qua topics model may actually turn out to look like a kind of a social credit system where some people who are members of more valuable topics will receive a kind of a higher credit score and receive perhaps different kinds of treatment from various kinds of websites. So that's still to be worked out. And I think the biggest objection is that it will make Google and then companies that do business with this new model, like Facebook perhaps, huge data monopolists. So they will become much more monopolistic of our personal data and how to use it than the old third-party auction system of data tracking.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting part about these flocks is that it's not the cookie type model, but so you gain some anonymity, but you're still grouped. And, so it's not trackable to the private person, but it's still tracking by interest. And I wanted to ask about these flocks because it made me think about a bigger point, which is these technology companies, like other big conglomerates before them, are essentially smarter and more agile than governments. And I mean, it's a somewhat sad state of affairs, but I think the fact is that some of the brightest minds in human civilization are putting their talents to juicing more engagement out of tweens, for example. and that is what it is. But I'm curious to get your take on the agility of these tech companies to find solutions around government initiatives, because these companies are in the business of problem solving. Might we be in a situation where these companies can simply outsmart and work around any potential government regulation?
I think that's what we're already looking at. I mean, there was very little love for cookies and third-party vendors to begin with. Some companies, as I said, Apple being one of them, began to allow people to not be tracked in certain ways. And yes, the answer is that, of course, these companies will continue to work around regulations. And so there's always going to be a chase involving regulators and companies. And the direction that the companies are going suggests their power. I mean, so if Google and Facebook and a few other really large platform companies begin to own more data and sell it at, you know, values that they can more or less establish, that doesn't solve any problems. But it does suggest that they are powerful enough to think they can get away with it. And we will see whether that turns out to be true.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about. Brain is kind of spinning. But I have a couple additional questions about extra parliamentary solutions to tech regulation. And I think now would be a good time to outline some of the key principles that you advocate for in the paper. And those deal with the intersection of democracy and markets, set against the backdrop of what you refer to as existential moral and environmental concerns. So rather than ask how to regulate tech, I'd be curious to hear more about how you're thinking of this overarching framework more broadly.
Well, I think that regulators need a value scheme to use to think creatively about what they're doing. So far, what's been proposed are largely processes, stakeholder processes, where states and governments will bring different stakeholders, users and interest communities and NGOs that are concerned about privacy and other aspects of data ownership and use. That all of those things are subject to the question of, well, but what values are we using to decide how the regulations will look? And so it seems to me that we have problems in four big social value areas. One is democracy itself. I mean, the platforms are not responsible for the disinformation and the hate and the sort of corruption of various kinds of democratic processes. But they amplify some of those issues. So how do we protect democracy without having to run around and regulate the 50 different areas where there are democratic threats emerging? And it may be that the end result will involve something like narrowing the democratic challenges down to, can we protect elections? And can we protect certain institutions from being attacked? And can we protect certain vulnerable groups in society from being attacked? And that may be a better way to go, but the democratic challenge is just one of several. In addition, there is kind of the moral challenge of what Shoshana Zuboff has called surveillance capitalism. And surveillance capitalism is not just about privacy. I mean, it begins with privacy. So we are freely offering a pretty good section of our personal lives up for auction and use by these companies. But maybe the more interesting challenge, and this is where I think Zuboff's book comes into play much more sort of interesting ways, is that she raises the moral concern about behavioral engineering. I mean, the idea isn't just that, you know, can we offer up somebody's consumption patterns so that we can better target them with ads. It is actually designing our needs. It is helping engineer our wants, helping us decide what we really need next. And so that is a moral challenge. I mean, if you flash back to sort of the beginning of Zuboff's argument about behavioral engineering, she goes back to B.F. Skinner, who was a very controversial figure in psychology a half century ago. And Skinner felt that behavioral engineering was a good way to get people to do what we want. But the question is, who's we and what do we want? And are there limits to how we can condition people to behave in certain ways, particularly when it comes to conditioning their patterns of voting? Do they see a particular candidate as representing them? And if so, how do they see that? And why do they see that? And is it because the algorithms actually make us feel that these candidates or these parties are helping, you know, represent us? And then beyond that issue of the perception and the engineering of our own needs and wants and voting behaviors and consumer behaviors, we end up getting into an area that is another of the value scheme elements that I think we need to talk about, which is the environmental impacts of all this. I mean, if you take companies like Amazon or, I mean, most of the tech companies are kind of consumer oriented. And so at a time when the planet is having serious environmental crises, I mean, many different kinds of crises, species extinction, climate change and global warming, chemical pollution and toxics, all of which kind of, you know, feed in one way or another in or out of patterns of human consumption and waste and resource depletion. And so what we're not really seeing is the important role of these companies in driving elements that contribute pretty directly to the environmental crisis. And then add to that the fact that the energy use, many of these companies are trying to, you know, claim or aim for carbon neutrality and so on, but it's tricky how you actually calculate, you know, your carbon footprint if you're Microsoft or if you're Apple or Google. And so the question of energy consumption, the algorithms themselves, I mean, the really big AI algorithms that some of these companies are developing take enormous energy to train. Just to train these algorithms is a big energy consumption. So, and then you have a whole other areas such as cryptocurrencies, you know, based on blockchain models, which consume huge amounts of energy. And there is a kind of the hope that there is going to be some kind of sustainable energy driving all of the servers that are used to generate both the algorithms, but also the blockchain solutions for cryptocurrencies and so on. And so that is not being calculated. And there are whistleblowers inside companies who've told us at the risk of their own jobs how much energy is involved here. And there have been audits. Greenpeace did an interesting, you know, environmental impact audit of the big tech companies. And I think the highest one, and I can't remember exactly, was a C plus. So that's not a great rating for the tech industries on environmental terms.
Absolutely. And I'd like to pick up directly on this idea of environmental impact. And you mentioned about the energy use, and you write in the paper about how each round of training for Google's BERT model leaves a carbon footprint roughly equivalent to a passenger seat on a US cross-country flight. And I think it's trained quite periodically. And I think that brings up an interesting dynamic where, on the one hand, the employees of these companies are often considered extremely progressive. Yet on the other, they are also contributing to massive pollution. And so you discuss in the paper how one potential route of this democratic disruption is internal pressure from within the companies themselves, as we've seen with the whistleblowers that you just mentioned. And so I'm curious to hear what you think of this dynamic between progressive employees contributing to not so progressive environmental practices.
I think that's a very interesting question. I mean, we've certainly seen a parade of whistleblowers and a parade of people who've been more or less pushed out. In fact, some of them involving the revelation of how much energy costs are involved in some of these, you know, very high-end models. And it may well be that the strongest check on some of the moral and environmental and political abuses of the companies come from their own employees. And there are now in many companies sort of ethics groups, formal or informal ethics groups, that actually try to screen developments proposed by the business side, by the legal side. But the interesting question is what we don't know, although I do have some access to a couple of companies that are, you know, looking to change their business model, where ethics issues have been raised inside the company. But then they become hard to reconcile against the business gains, let's say, of more data ownership and value for that data ownership. And how do you reconcile that internally? And I'm guessing, and this is where I would like to be a fly on the wall, I'd like to be an observer inside some of these companies, but it's very hard to believe that the ethics concerns of employee groups, who are often not at the highest level of the corporate hierarchies, will balance the interests of business decisions and the legal department.
Yeah, I mean, we have seen examples of employees kind of walking out or, you know, making these letters, but I do wonder that fundamentally all of them are generating, whether it's Amazon through their boxes or Google through their BERT training, that the carbon footprint is huge. And I wonder, do you know of any, do they try to offset this somehow? I mean, is that some way to go about it? Can they, for example, plant more trees or buy out, you know, carbon taxation or something? I mean, are they offsetting?
Well, there are claims that they are, and to some extent, I'm guessing that they're doing some things, such as using sustainable energy sources, actually developing sustainable energy sources for some of their products. But at the same time, it's hard to evaluate their own internal accounting procedures. So, for example, Microsoft has claimed that it's going to be carbon neutral in the foreseeable future. But what about Microsoft's technology contributions to the oil industry? So if you put that into the equation, it's very unlikely that Microsoft will ever be carbon neutral. But then if you cut off their accounting at the front door when the products go out, that's different than if you actually follow the products through their path into other industries that have environmental impacts.
Right, the externality problem, basically. So I'd like to turn over to some potentially non-regulatory ways out of this democratic disruption. We started out by talking about capitalism and markets. And based on that, I wonder, can the market simply fix this? We've seen a host of privacy-oriented services rolling out as alternatives to major tech offerings, like DuckDuckGo instead of Google Search, or the Brave browser instead of Google Chrome. Might there be a scenario where the invisible hand saves the day? Or are consumers simply too satisfied with the quality of services offered by the major tech companies?
Well, there's always going to be alternatives. I think that some of the regulators, particularly in Europe, are hoping for those competitors to be more competitive in the future. But so far, DuckDuckGo has been out there for a long time. Mozilla has been out there for a long time. Mozilla produces a really high-quality product, which has a lot of privacy protections and data protections attached to it. And yet it is so far from being a dominant player in the market. So this gets back to the issue of, you know, there are several factors in the equation, and one of which is users who want something that works well, that works easily, that integrates with other devices, and that actually is something that, in terms of like social media platforms, for example, that has the capacity to bring you a lot more information and to spread your content as widely as possible. So since we are now in the age of social influencers and the dream of particularly young people to become social influencers, the platforms and technologies employed are probably always going to lean toward the dominant players in the market. So I don't see the market correcting itself.
Mm. Well, the second solution I thought of, the extra parliamentary solution, and I know this gets even to, you know, more speculative territory, is a radical transformation of the web's architecture along the lines of, you know, these ongoing discussions around Web3. And in a sense, that would kind of be a disruption of the existing platform architecture, which itself disrupted the World Wide Web. So potentially, we're nearing a creative destruction, to use Schumpeter's term, of the platform lifecycle. Or do you think that the core business models of these tech companies will remain unchanged, even if the underlying architecture does?
Well, the business models are constantly being updated, as we talked to a few minutes ago, not just in the effort to keep ahead of regulators and throw new challenges to the regulators, but also to improve the business. I mean, Zuboff's book, to go back to surveillance capitalism again, you know, noted that Google, for example, and the Chrome browser basically started out as simply having ads on search pages and not necessarily targeting and selling your data based on your entire search history or some substantial part of it. So I think that the idea of constantly changing, I mean, this gets also back to the idea of creative destruction and being disruptive, is that the businesses themselves forget about, for the moment, where they're trying to keep ahead of regulators, but just thinking about ways to grow the bottom line and finding new business model elements that will help them do that. So that's where Google has come in with first the Flocks idea and now the Topics idea. And if Topics doesn't work, we'll find out what's next after Topics. But the idea of developing better ways of assessing the value of us in the use of these platforms, which is free, but the cost, of course, is high in terms of democracy, in terms of personal privacy, in terms of our sort of social value around that. And so there are a lot of elements there that come into play that are always going to be driving new business models and change in that sense. So I see that there's two dimensions, and it could be that the corporations own innovation, just as Google realized that if we are tracked and if we become targeted based on the tracking, then our value is greater for them, not for us. I mean, they give us some value. Obviously, people feel that there's enough value in products that work well for us that we are willing to pay in terms of our privacy because it doesn't appear to be costing us very much.
Interesting. And lastly, a bit of a reflective question for you, and one I'm most excited to ask, in fact, is that many of our listeners will know you from your theory of connective action, which outlined how new forms of digital mobilization were ingrained in the DNA of social media platforms. And that was around the time of vibrant civic activism like the Arab Spring and Occupy Wall Street movement. And I mean, in light of all the democratic disruption we've been discussing, how has your thinking changed about this collective action potential? Of course, it's still there. But have these platforms simply evolved into something fundamentally different in ways that disincentivize what we might consider as positive forms of civic engagement?
Not necessarily. The idea was that this goes back, indeed, the early cases that I was looking at with a number of colleagues, Alexandra Segerberg from Uppsala University and a number of other colleagues, was the observation that the capacity to organize today because of platforms looks very different than the old nature of collective action, which required organizations and resources and the capacity to actually get people to overcome their natural dispositions to let others do the work for them. But that was possible to overcome because social movements, for example, of all stripes, often become attractive because they are also able to provide communities for people who share common problems. But it often took resources and formal brick and mortar organizations to create collective organization. And so what we began to see with, you know, going way back to the Arab Spring and to the Indignados, to Occupy Wall Street, and coming forward today to Black Lives Matter and a number of contemporary networked organization is what we called connective action. And connective action is a very low resource form of organization that is sustained by large networks that may have facilitators, it may have people and groups in them that produce resources of value to others in the networks and keep those people involved and allow those people to stay involved because social media invites us to tell our personal stories about being a Black person, about being someone who's lost their health insurance, about being someone who's feeling that they're disadvantaged because society doesn't offer them enough opportunities to succeed. And those stories become the kind of the glue of these networks. And so it's the constant refreshment of often very large networks. Occupy Wall Street had millions and millions of people who went global. Black Lives Matter has now gone global. And those networks are sustained by the contribution of individuals who have stories to share and others who have their own stories and affirm the stories of others. So that process is an organizational process that is supplementary to the old models of collective action. So we now have a sort of a continuum of traditional collective action, which involves resources and formal organization to try to mobilize others. Political parties have long practiced this stuff. To, at the other end of the continuum, more or less flat, distributed connective action, which is much of what Occupy Wall Street or the Spanish Indignados produced, and sustain for a good long time. But those tend to disappear over time because they lack the capacity to sustain themselves. And then there's a kind of a middle set of cases in which relatively modest organizations such as NGOs in different sectors, from human rights to economic justice and environmental justice, are helping to organize large numbers of people in shared action. So that seems to me to be the sweet spot. So you get away from the need for having formal organization with high resources, such as political parties or labor unions, to mobilize their people, to a sort of much less resource-intensive set of organizations, such as environmental NGOs, who have the capacity to use technologies creatively to facilitate ongoing action. So the question, of course, then becomes, are we going to end up having political parties that look like that? And will those parties be able to compete effectively in elections? There have been a number of experiments. The Cinque Stelle movement in Italy, which turned into a political party, the Five Star Party, which is a very interesting and kind of strange configuration. The Indignados protests in Spain sort of morphed in a way into the Podemos Party, which now is not only in parliament, but participates in power and government. But the question is, as Podemos became part of the institutional structure of Spanish government, it lost a number, I mean, like millions of its social movement base, which was originally thought to be the sort of energy for the party. And now a lot of the activists in the early days of that party, not so long ago, 5, 6, 7 years ago, have now felt that the party is playing the game like all parties do, and so it's just another political party.
Interesting to see if parties follow the same dynamics of this connective action. I hadn't thought about that. But super interesting chat. Many of our listeners will know some of your work, but I definitely encourage them to check out the Killing the Golden Goose paper. There'll be a link down in the episode description. So thank you so much, Professor Bennett, for taking the time out and sharing your insights with us.
Thanks for a very fun conversation.
I've just been speaking with Lance Bennett, Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Communication at the University of Washington. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Next time, we'll have Eric Wilson back on the podcast to discuss the latest tech and digital campaigning strategies heading into the 2022 U.S. midterms. But until then, I'm your host, Michael Becerra, signing off from Melba. See you next time.